Howard and Kurt invited me to come not to give a formal lecture, but to take your questions. I have reason to believe that some of you are familiar enough with some of the things that I've read that you could lob questions at me. I thought I would just start off, though, saying a few words of about who I am, what I'm interested in, how I got here, just as a prelude to taking questions and engaging in discussion. This is my third time at Harvard. I got my PhD here in the Department of Psychology after getting a bachelor's degree in experimental psychology at McGill University in Montreal, which is where I'm from. I then did a postdoc at MIT and returned to Harvard as an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology, but lasted there 1 year, took a job at Stanford, then took a job at MIT, and lasted there 21 years before returning just over the summer. My main research interest is in language. Like Howard, one of my mentors at Harvard was the late Roger Brown, who pretty much founded the scientific study of language development in the late 1950s. I also did work on visual cognition, visual imagery, visual attention, shape recognition. My dissertation was on that topic under the supervision of Steve Coslin, who is still here in the Department of Psychology. But for the last 10 years, all my empirical research has been on language. Among the work that I've done in language was trying to develop a comprehensive theory of language development, of how children start off not knowing anything about the particular language they're going to be exposed to, but figure out its words and rules, and are thereafter able to understand and compose sentences that they haven't actually heard before. I've looked at two sub-problems within that general question. One of them is how children figure out how to use verbs in sentences, the interest of that being that the verb pretty much dictates the structure of the sentence, and so once you have figured out how the verbs work, you've kind of figured out a lot about how the language works. And then my more recent research activity looking at one little corner of language as a model organism with which to try to understand language processes in general. That's been the study of regular and irregular past tenses and plurals, the difference between walk walked on the one hand and come came or break broke on the other. The idea is that for a regular past tense form, like walk walked, you form it by sticking a suffix onto a verb. That act of combining two things to make a new thing is, I think, the essence of grammatical combination, what makes language so powerful. There's no limit to the number of thoughts we can express in language, and that's because we don't simply memorize what we hear, but we have generative rules to create new sentences expressing new thoughts. An idea that, at least in modern times, is most strongly associated with my former MIT colleague, Noam Chomsky. But looking at the process of adding an ED to a verb is a very simple, pure, minimal example of this power, and we see it exercised even in preschool children when they make errors like braked and cummed and holded and throwed up, and when in experiments, including one supervised by Roger Brown in the late 50s by Jean Berko Gleason, you bring a child into a lab and say, here is a man who knows how to wug, he did the same thing yesterday, and children will fill in the blank by saying he wugged. Both of those are cases, both wugged and holded, are cases where children aren't just reproducing verbatim what they've heard from their parents, but are flaunting this power of creative grammatical combination. Then the irregular forms that make these errors possible, like hold, held, come, came, are a kind of control, because the fact that they're unpredictable means that you have to have memorized them. You can't have created them on the fly by a rule, and so they're a nice control between what I think of as the two main processes of language, namely storage of words in memory, what you have to do for come came, and creation of new forms by rule, what you have to do for wug wugged or hold holded. The other activity that I've been engaged in is writing books with an intended wide audience on the areas of psychology and psycholinguistics that I find interesting. I've written a couple of books on language, a book with the modest title, How the Mind Works, which tried to lay out a general framework for understanding the mind by merging two approaches, the approach of cognitive science and the approach of evolutionary psychology. My most recent book, The Blank Slate, addressed the question of why issues about human nature, what is innate, what is learned, what kind of emotions are universal across the species, what kind vary from one culture to another, why they're not just scientific questions, but have aroused so much political and moral and emotional energy and anxiety. So I try to lay out why theories of human nature are not just scientific topics, but at least in the eyes of many, also political topics, and how we might separate them. So that's pretty much how I my recent activity. I guess how are we going to ask me about how why here now?
Yeah, I was going to ask you a hard question, which is why he came to Harvard and what he plans to do here, but particularly with reference to what you want to teach and what kind of new contacts you may want to make with other departments and intellectual strands.
Yeah.
In a sense, how Harvard is different from MIT.
Yeah. Well, I was, yeah, I'm happy to answer that because it's sort of salient in my mind these days. MIT is a wonderful place to be a student, to be a graduate student, to be on the faculty, and I left that job after many sleepless nights and still some ambivalence. One of the main reasons is that I was there so long. I kind of did the math and figured out that it was 21 years, 22 if you include my postdoc, and that I thought a change of scenery would be intellectually stimulating. And though MIT had many close fits to my intellectual interests, in particular its excellence in linguistics and psycholinguistics and its strength in vision and in neuroscience. But as I started to write about larger topics, such as in my books How the Mind Works and The Blank Slate, I thought that I would have more to learn from a full-service university with, for example, a school of education. MIT had a program in education in the 70s, since long ago dissolved, but education is clearly one of those areas of thought that is very closely tied to notions about human nature, in particular language. Likewise, the law school, Department of English, School of Government, program in organismic and evolutionary biology. MIT has one of the world's best biology departments with a number of Nobel Prize winners, but they don't study anything bigger than a molecule. Here, I guess there are two biology departments reflecting the shift in the organization of biology itself. I am interested in molecular biology, but I'm also interested in butterflies and monkeys and chimpanzees and mice and so on. And so the presence of strong evolutionary biology, including ties to anthropology, biological anthropology, another discipline not represented at MIT, makes the full menu of intellectual offerings here appealing. And then finally, there's the psychology department itself, my home, which is weaker in some areas than my former department at MIT, but represents many areas that MIT, by policy, is not interested in, such as social psychology, evolutionary psychology, and other parts of the discipline. In terms of teaching, I'll be teaching in the spring a core course called The Human Mind, which is similar to a course I taught at MIT for 6 years, which was MIT's version of Introduction to Psychology. It's different from a psychology course in that I try to give the subject matter an organizing framework, which most psychology courses don't do. I organize it in terms of the concepts of evolution and computation. It's my somewhat idiosyncratic organization. At MIT, I was under constant pressure not to make it too much of a science course because it satisfied the social science and humanities distribution requirement, and there was concern that it not be used as an excuse for MIT students to just take more science and get out of actually having to read a book. Here, the pressure is, since it satisfies the science B core requirement, not to make it too much of a social science course and to make sure that it's not an excuse for Harvard students to get out of taking a science course, which has led my former colleagues at MIT to say what counts as a humanities at MIT counts as a science course at Harvard. But in any case, I will teach it in a way that I think is intellectually respectable in both ways. There will be a graduate companion course that will at least at first be restricted to TFs for the course, although I might, depending on how manageable it is, try to expand it to other suitable graduate students. In terms of other courses, I'm talking now with a faculty member at the law school, Roberto Mangabeira Unger, about possibly co-teaching a course on human nature and its various implications and tentacles in other fields of knowledge, not just biology, but law, government, literature, education, and so on. And so he and I are talking about that. That would be for not this academic year, but next academic year. So we open up to questions? Okay. Does anyone have any questions, comments? Yes.
All right. I'm excited to have you here. I'm just going to ask the obvious first question, which is, what kind of research has been done on helping figure out what that 40 or 50% is? That may be environment, it may be peers, it may be more genetics that we haven't looked into. Mm-hmm. Determining the differences that we see between children.
Right. I'll give some background. This is an allusion to what I consider to be one of the great unsolved problems in the history of psychology, which is that if you look at normal variation within a culture, say within more or less Western middle class culture, and just about anything you measure, intelligence, personality, behavior of various kinds, and you ask what makes one individual different from another individual, the answer usually turns out to be about 50% of the variation is genetic. That is, if you take identical twins, separate them at birth, and measure them as adults, so they share their genes but not their environment, the correlations are in the range of 0.5. About 0 to 5% is what behavioral geneticists call shared environment or common environment. These are similarities that can be attributed to growing up in the same family. So if you take two adopted children, bring them up as siblings within a family, they don't share their genes, they do share their environment. How correlated are they as adults? And the answer is hardly at all. And then the remaining 45 to 50% is the mystery factor. I called it the Mr. Jones factor after the Bob Dylan chorus. Something is happening here, but we don't know what it is. You don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? I'll tell you my hunch. This has been dismissed as the most gloomy, pessimistic, cynical, depressing possibility of all, which is that it's due to chance. Chance in the assembly of the brain in utero, whether a neuron zigged or zagged, or the growth cone of an axon during as the brain gelled in the womb, and perhaps chance in life, who got the top bunk bed, who got the bottom bunk bed, whether you were dropped on your head or inhaled a virus or something caught your fancy when you were 3 years old and your identical twin didn't happen to notice it, sets you off on a train of thought. The next time you see something similar, you think about it even more, and so on. Why? Well, logically, there aren't a whole lot of alternatives. If you think back now to identical twins not reared apart, but the more conventional case of identical twins reared together, okay? Now, okay, think about it for a second. They share all their genes. They share pretty much all their environment. Same parents, same home, same neighborhood, same number of books in the home, same number of guns in the home, same number of TVs in the home, same, pretty much same peer group most of the time, which I think eliminates choice of peer groups as a differentiating factor. Well, what's left? Seems to me that what's left is chance. Other alternatives, I'll mention some other alternatives. Parent-child interaction effects. Well, there's a lot of discussion of that as a kind of escape hatch that would possibly rescue parents from the seemingly unimportant role that this research would relegate them to. I should just mention by way of credit that the idea that the home and parents have less of an effect than most people think, maybe no effect in terms of shaping of adult personality and intelligence, was made famous by a book by Judith Rich Harris that came out about 5 years ago, The Nurture Assumption, based in turn on earlier work by behavioral geneticists such as David Rowe, who wrote a book called The Limits of Family Influence, Robert Plowman, who in a remarkable article in 1987 with Denise Daniels had posed the question, why are siblings in the same family so different, and Sandra Scar. Anyway, this is a bit of a digression of that one of the implications of the initial finding is that parents don't seem to have a strong shaping role in personality. The escape hatch is that perhaps it's individualized parenting, not the parental style that's common across children in a home, which is what behavioral genetic studies can measure, but perhaps the individualized parenting that is unique to each child. I think that's very unlikely to account for the Mr. Jones factor, partly because to the extent that parents treat children differently because the children are different, and indeed some micro studies of parent-child interaction show that most of the differences in parenting are predictable based on the personality of the child, then any such effects would actually get sucked into the genetics term of the equation, not the non-shared variance or non-shared environment or unexplained variance term. Also, a true interaction in the analysis of variance sense, not in the interaction is an ambiguous word, because in common sense usage, it refers to a process that goes back and forth between two people. But that's the one that would be mostly accounted for by the genetic term. In the statistician sense, if you've all taken analysis of variance course and you know what a 2x2 interaction is, it refers to a variable that has a different effect depending on the value of some other variable, which is not the same as an interaction in the sense of two people interacting. Now, for that kind of interaction to explain the missing variance, which at least it's in principle capable of doing, you would have to have it so that the effect of parent A on a child of, say, personality type A is the opposite of the effect of parent B on a child of personality type A, and vice versa for a child with the opposite personality type. That is, being stern with some kids makes them shyer, being stern with other kids makes them bolder. And that, crucially, across the board, these effects cancel out. The reason they have to cancel out is that if they didn't, then the effect of shared environment would have to be significant, and as I mentioned, it generally is not 0 to 5% of the variance. So that kind of interaction, I think, is very unlikely to account for the missing variance. So that leads me, again, back to chance. The final reason to take chance seriously is that we have reason to believe in development in general in the animal kingdom. Chance has a role to play, that even biologists who study monotonously indistinguishable organisms like inbred fruit flies or roundworms and bring them up under unbelievably well-controlled laboratory conditions, like, you know, a dish kept at constant temperature in a lab, the organisms aren't indistinguishable. They might differ in longevity. They might differ in whether they have more bristles under the right wing or under the left wing in the case of fruit flies. And if we know that in cases like that, there's variability, how could there not be variability in something as complex as a human brain? So that, which would suggest, by the way, that the role of genes in developing the brain is really to kind of keep it within certain bounds, and that there's a fair amount of random variation within those boundary conditions. The final thing, you alluded to as yet undiscovered genetic factors. There is some scope for that. I don't think it would account for all of the unexplained variants, but it's possible that identical twins are not exactly clones in terms of their nuclear DNA, but that there may be mutations after the fertilized ovum splits into two, which would mean that identical twins are not really identical. Some of the unexplained variants, therefore, could be genetic of a kind that we're not very good at measuring, which would mean that the genetic term has been underestimated. But that's, in fact, Chris Walsh in the medical school is investigating that possibility, but so far we don't really know.
May I ask a question? I have the. If you attribute 50% of the differences to genetic and 45% to 50% to mystery Jones factor, and so little, and so much is innate, and so little is learned.
No, wait, stop. Okay. Not so little is learned.
So little is learned.
No. Mm-hmm. So little is attributable to the home and parents.
Shared environment.
Yes.
Right.
Not the same as learned.
Oh, okay.
You don't just learn from your parents.
Uh-huh.
You learn from your culture. You learn from your peers. I should also mention, sorry to interrupt you, but just it is a rather important point. I preface the problem by saying that these are individual differences within a culture. So that is why is Mary different from Sally, both of whom are middle to upper class members of a Western democracy. In terms of, say, what makes an American different from a Yanomama warrior, or what makes a member of the working class different from a member of the middle class, working class where they might be outside the sample of adoptive parents, then that's a kind of difference that isn't even measured in these studies, and that clearly reflects enormous amounts of learning, but that's kind of outside of this problem. And even inside this problem, remember that the 50% of the variance that's unexplained for is not might involve a great deal of learning, just not things that two siblings would learn in the same way from the same parents.
Okay. So would you put the education to the attribute that to the shared environment or the mystery Jones factor? And what is your view of education? Are you skeptical or pessimistic even about education?
I better not be, because here I am in a university and in a school of education within a university. Again, these measures don't, the phenomena that we're dealing with don't deal with things like how well do you understand calculus or algebra or arithmetic. They tend to measure more, because there, clearly, if you've never gone to school, there's no way you could know algebra. They tend to measure what we think of as more long-standing traits in a person, such as general intelligence, ability to learn as opposed to that which is learned, personality traits, how anxious, how self-confident, how conscientious, how sloppy, how nice, how nasty, certain behaviors such as addictions, tendency to get into trouble with the law, tendency to get divorced, and so on. But in terms of education, I mean, it should go without saying that if you don't go to school, you're not going to, you know, learn a lot of important stuff like, you know, reading and writing and mathematics and general knowledge of the culture and so on. Whether education can change your personality is another question, and I would certainly be skeptical that education would change your personality, but it does. I mean, it's almost, I almost feel embarrassed to say this, but clearly it's crucially important.
Oh.
We'll start with Rebecca.
Go ahead.
Okay,
we'll
I.
Sorry. Okay, you're next.
I take issue with some of your
correlations that you draw about being twins. I am an identical twin and grew up in a school that I think is probably a bit of an anomaly, that there were eight other sets of twins in this small school. And so when I hear studies about twins and twin research, it always kind of makes my hackles go up. But I think it is unequally or a bit biased in that researchers talk about twins being clones of one another, physical, mental, emotional clones of another person. And my first question would be, who is the clone of the other? And my second question would be that people tend to study twins' similarities, that there is this urge to study similarities between people, between cultures, between things like that. And there is no study of contrast. In other words, that you put twins together in a category of, here is our control group. Here are two people that are supposed to be genetically similar. Or, if you look at it as genetic cloning, that they should be genetically identical, which, if you look at any DNA studies of twins, is not true. But also, that people don't look at differences. And when you mention in your section on twins that when you study twins reared apart and that you notice these three glaring similarities, which are idiosyncratic similarities, and I can say do happen between twins either reared together or reared apart, as I've known both, but all that's focused on is the similarities and none of the differences that can occur. So then when you base your research, say my question would be then on criminally deviant behavior or something along those lines. When you're basing research on the idea of this similarity and the idea that a lot of this is genetic, how do you explain then deviant behavior? How do you explain abnormal behavior when you start out with the idea of genetic cloning or twins being clones of one another when even that isn't exactly the case?
Okay, let me deal with these separately. The idea that model zygotic twins are clones is a statement that's, it's not, of course, literally true, because there are differences between a zygote splitting and a somatic cell receiving nuclear transfer. But it does allude to the fact that with the exception of possible mutations, as I mentioned in the answer to the previous question, the DNA of identical twins is identical, minus somatic mutations, whose extent I don't think we know, but can't be very, very large. The same in terms of studying differences or similarities, let me just be clear, that the research, which, by the way, again, to give credit where it's due, I have not published any research on identical or fraternal twins in terms of their personality or intelligence. I'm engaged in the study of language development in twins, but the work that I'm alluding to so far should be attributed to people like Plowman, Nancy Siegel, Thomas Bouchard, and collaborators, and a number of others. The same research that looks at the similarities also looks at the differences, and indeed, our whole conversation so far about the unexplained 50% or the Mr. Jones factor is about differences between identical twins. That's the whole point. If there were no differences between identical twins reared together, there'd be no Mr. Jones factor or 50% unexplained variance. So it's not something that's neglected. It's the whole thing that we're talking about. And including some striking differences, such as discordance in schizophrenia, where you can have one identical twin schizophrenic, the other one not. Although, that having been said, it's also worth saying that having an identical twin who's schizophrenic is the statistically strongest predictor of being schizophrenic. It's just not a perfect predictor. Likewise, sexual orientation is far more concordant in identical twins than in any other pair of people, but again, it's not perfect, so you can have one twin who's gay, one twin who's straight. That is the Mr. Jones factor, so it's not something that's ignored. It's something that this research was instrumental in documenting to begin with. Yes, Stacey.
When you were talking earlier about the Mr. Jones factor, you mentioned something interesting, which was kids growing up together, you know, the bunk bed, the chance elements. One of the things you mentioned was seeing something, that maybe it sparks something in their mind, they see it later, they get on a train of thought. If we look at the chance factor from that perspective as more of a positive thing instead of this sort of negative element that we can't figure out, but a positive area that's full of potential. How do you think education could make use of that?
Well, it depends on what the goal of education is thought to be, because you know, if the goal of education is to change personality, then you know, it's maybe that we should follow kids around with a video camera and keep a complete record of what they look at, and you know, when they have a dreamy, far-off look in their eyes afterwards, and so on. But it may be that that's not that this whole problem is not a fundamental problem for education. That education should be dealing with aspects of a person that are kind of not even in the set of things that this research measures, such as, you know, do you know something about the countries of the world? Do you know something about the Western and world history? Do you know something about evolution? Do you know something about major cultural accomplishments of our culture? These are all things that this research isn't really about, because it aims to look at stable traits of a person rather than things that are unquestionably learned. So, I mean, it's not clear that educators should be interested in it, but maybe something else that we can talk about. I haven't been keeping track of the order, but so I'll follow the mic.
Yeah. So I have a question when you talk about this chance factor, that if so much as 50% can be up to chance, isn't there a way for parents to influence the chance? I mean, parents do a lot for their kids, and can't they put their kids in an environment that, like, influence the chance of them have positive influences?
Well, it depends. Well, it depends. If it's chance events in the wiring of the brain in the womb, then probably not. I mean, other than to keep it from going awry by the mother making sure that she has enough of the right, you know, vitamins and trace nutrients, and you know, not drinking and so on. If it's unpredictable events in the child's life, then exerting influence over it might mean kind of turning the family into a totalitarian fascist dictatorship where you just follow the child around, just make sure that he's always looking at the right thing, and even then it's not clear that would help. To the extent, by the way, that some of the let me take another step back in terms, again, what we're talking about here. The debate over the role of parents actually is two debates, or two issues. One of them is personality, intelligence, other stable traits of a person within a culture. The other is socialization, that is how you acquire the skills, norms, background knowledge of your culture. For the former, I suggested that peers probably have not that much of an influence, simply because, again, going back to our touchstone of identical twins reared together, they're very likely to share their peer groups. Nonetheless, they're not perfectly correlated, so there must be something other than peers that make them different. In the case of socialization, though, learning your native language, learning acceptable ways of behaving in public, tastes in music and art, values such as whether doing well in school makes you cool or makes you a dweeb. All of those things, I think, are, and here I do agree with Harris, are likely to be far more influenced by the peer group than by the parents. Here it's not behavioral genetic studies that are most relevant, but studies of immigrants, where if you look at who children resemble more, in cases where the reason that immigration is the crucial test case is that's in non-immigrant children, their peer culture and their parents' parental culture are the same, and so, or at least are perfectly correlated, so you don't know which one's making the difference. In the case of immigration, you have one set of cultural values in the home, one set in the peer group, and you can see which one is more influential. And certainly in terms of language, the most dramatic case is accent. Kids end up with the accent of their peers, not their parents. They don't even end up with an accent halfway between their peers and their parents. It's 100% peers. So that's, now, insofar then as the peer group may be decisive for socialization, maybe not for personality, the other question, but for socialization, then parents do have an effect in choosing their kids' peer group, what neighborhood they live in, what school they send them to, and so on. It's not an effect of parenting directly, but it's an indirect effect of what the parents do. Oh, yes.
Just kind of elaborating on what you were saying. So I guess what you call chance actually includes a lot of different types of explanations, including biological and social ones. And that, like, for instance, would you consider someone having a good teacher versus a bad teacher a matter of chance? And that's something that I think some aspects of chance we don't have control over, and some that are chance we do have control over. And the other thing is that it seems that what you're saying is that that at least within a class and within a society, that the differences between parenting methods are not as great as the differences caused by genetics. Not that your environment overall doesn't affect you, that maybe the range of possible environments is itself relatively narrow.
Yeah. Now, that's it's an important methodological point in interpreting this research, in that the variation that we're dealing with is typically, depending on the study, either the variation among a large sample of adoptive families, which are not a random sample of the population, or in twin studies, whoever gets netted into the study, which in the case of some Scandinavian countries can be most or all of the population, although, again, a Scandinavian country might represent a narrower range than in a more cosmopolitan country such as ours. Variations outside that range, including, say, different teachers in cases where, again, identical twins might be assigned to different teachers, could definitely go into that term of unexplained causes of these personality differences. I should mention, though, that the two main types of research that have supported the hypothesis that parents are overrated are studies of twins and adoptees. But there are other corroborating bodies of research that I think converge on this conclusion in terms of socialization. One of them is it's very hard to measure any effect of holding culture constant, a family structure, on personality and intelligence, such as being an only child versus having siblings, holding culture constant, being brought up by a single mother, going to daycare, versus a stay-at-home mother, being brought up in a hippie commune versus an Aussie and Harriet suburban home, being brought up by two lesbian mothers. None of these have long-term strong effects on most of the things that we measure. Again, holding culture constant. Okay. Now, it's, for example, the reason that that's an important proviso is that in some cases, like fatherlessness, there are many correlates of fatherlessness, most of them not very good, but fatherlessness tends to also be correlated with a class difference and a neighborhood difference. If you look at middle class families, say where a father died and the child was brought up by the mother in a middle class household, there are very, very few differences. How did we go? Okay, Alexis, yes.
Okay, I have a two-part question for you. Since your book is intended for this wide audience, what is your goal for this wide audience to take away or to put into action for change? And then along with that, since this class is helping to bridge things directly into education, can you and how would you apply what you've done so far into education?
Okay. Because the question of human nature has been so politicized, I took pains in writing the book not to make it, in most cases, a manifesto for a particular political agenda, right-wing or left-wing. The argument that I took in the book, and which I will defend here, is that empirical discoveries about how the mind works can inform policy decisions but can't dictate them. The reason being that almost any interesting policy debate will combine assumptions about how the world works with some kind of a value statement. In most cases, there is going to be, if we're debating it at all, there's probably going to be a trade-off. You can have more of one thing, less of something else. What's the optimal point? Just to pick an example, should we screen kids by ability in school? Well, it might, depending on the particular way that they're streamed in the subject matter, it might help the kids at the top, hurt the kids at the bottom, or vice versa. So what should we do? Well, in a way, that's a question that the science itself can't answer. It depends on whether we as a democracy set as our goal the maximization of genius or the minimization of inequality. That's just one of many examples in which the empirical side can't itself dictate the answer to a question. But the best information about what the trade-off looks like, which is what the scientific side can provide, will make the debates better informed. So my goal would be to try to make figure out a way to make the debates better informed, in particular to have people recognize the trade-offs rather than assuming that if the facts come out one way, we must do one thing, and if the facts come out another way, we must do something else. In terms of implications for education, again, I try to be circumspect in the book, and I'll be circumspect now. Then, for one thing, just personally, having no classroom experience other than in a university, and not having immersed myself in the enormous literature on what works and what doesn't in educational settings, I necessarily have to be very vague. So here are just two ideas that I did throw out in the book that just might be sort of helpful. One of them is that the theory of what you want education to do and what it's there for, and therefore what has a better or worse chance of working. I think it's good to be clear about what kids do naturally and spontaneously because of the way evolution shaped their brain, and what are add-ons that are necessary in a modern industrial society, but which might involve skills that have only become necessary because of technological innovations of the last few thousand years, for which our brain probably did not evolve specializations. And the two most salient examples of that would be the contrast between reading and language. Well, there's, I think, reason to believe that language is an instinctive human ability, but that reading is not. Therefore, a philosophy of reading pedagogy that assumed that children would spontaneously develop the ability to read is, there'd be reason to be skeptical about it, at least as if it was based on an analogy between the spontaneous way in which they speak. And in math education, this is an argument that I borrowed from David Geary, that even though there is recent research, much of it associated with the psychology department here, that children have some innate number sense, it's a sense that's not going to take them very far in a modern mathematics curriculum. And so again, to develop skills like fractions, paper and pencil computation, and so on, throwing kids together in a rich, math-rich environment, having them solve problems communally, is unlikely to be a route to success, simply because there's no reason to believe kids are specialized for mathematics in that sense. And this is, and Howard has made a similar point in terms of other domains of knowledge, such as biology. There is some reason to believe that children are intuitive naturalists, that people are intuitive naturalists, but the kind of intuitive biology that we naturally apply or acquire interacting with living things is unlikely to give us, for example, Darwin's theory of natural selection, which is very unintuitive, very late developing, and probably taps mental faculties well above and beyond our intuitive naturalistic ability. So that's one kind of general way of framing the question is the most I would claim for. Another one, again, I'll have to give credit to Judy Harris for this, is that one gets a sense, and again, not being an expert, I'll have to say that this is a sense that I get, that much, probably a big predictor of school success, especially if you look at the full range of schools, say, from inner city, not very successful schools to upper middle class, more successful, say, private schools, a huge variable, I suspect, is going to be just the social context of what is valued, what it takes to get ahead in your peer group. If you belong to a peer group in which getting good grades is respected, then that, I think, is bound to lead to a very different learning situation than if you're in a peer group in which doing well in school is a sign of selling out or being uncool and losing respect within the group. And the question of how a teacher or a school system can, especially since this is Harris's main point, there's a natural tendency among children, as among people, to break into competitive groups to ally yourself with the values that grow up in a group and to differentiate the values of your group from another group. In a large class, there's a high likelihood that groups will break up into, you know, the brains, the jocks, the burnouts, the goths, etc. When that happens, then I suspect a lot of the battle is lost. And that if there was better understanding of group dynamics, especially in the teenage years, but even in the preteen years, and how adults can influence the mores of the groups that do develop, so that doing well in school is not a ticket to geekdom, but rather can be a sign of status, then I think that is going to be an enormous variable. And one other just connection, really in the same realm. The fact, for example, that school achievement is so different among ethnic groups, say among Asian American groups have math and science scores that are so much higher, is almost certainly attributable to the fact that the expectations of both of parents to children and children to other children that have developed in Asian American cultures are different from European American, African American, and other subcultures.
Yeah. Hi. I have a question about your noble savage idea.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why you need it in as part of your thesis. And this is the Rousseauian idea that people are generally born good. You call it romantic, a romantic ideal. And I think there are two problems I have with it. One is that in viewing that people are born good, they are born with some innate trait. So that goes against it's in conflict with the blank slate idea right off the bat. And secondly, it would imply that education, we don't need to, it would imply that if everyone's good, education can only have a bad effect on them. And I don't think our education system assumes that everyone's good. I think it assumes that people need to be educated to learn how to share character education trend that's going on that says we have no virtues and need to be taught them. So I wish you could comment on that.
Yeah, it is certainly true that the blank slate and the noble savage are don't logically entail one another. Although I think they tend to go together, and opposition to the idea of a rich human nature, I think, often combines a belief in the blank slate with a belief in the noble savage. And the reason is that good and evil are asymmetrical. That there's a lot more things that can go wrong in life than can go right, and it's a lot easier to hurt someone than to help them because we're such complex systems, and it doesn't take much to mess someone up, although to make them really better off is a lot tougher. And that's why we're apt to be more impressed by the absence of malice than by the presence of benevolence. And you see that in metaphors, such as the long set of metaphors that equate virtue with blankness, pure as the driven snow, untainted, unblemished, unmarked, and so on. And I think it's this psychological link between blankness and virtue that leads many of the critics of notions of human nature to especially home in on claims about human nature that are not particularly appetizing, such as claims that people are might be innately selfish or lustful or ethnocentric or greedy. Those are the ones that really get people's backs up. It's one of the reasons I think that, for example, Chomsky, who is one of the strongest innatists of the 20th century, did not get the kind of politicized attacks that someone like Ed Wilson got, even though in some ways Chomsky is a far more extreme nativist than Wilson is. But it's because what Chomsky said was innate was something that's kind of nice, the ability to talk and to create an infinite number of sentences. Whereas what Wilson said might be innate was things that are kind of nasty, like group against group conflict. And so even though if it was just the blank slate versus rich human nature that got people exercised, both of them would have been the subject of politicized attacks. It was Wilson who suffered the demonstrators. In terms of education, it's certainly, I mean, there are an awful lot of educational philosophies, and I think the one that I would associate most closely with the noble savage, both historically in terms of Rousseau's own writings on education and in actual practice, would be the kind of Summerhill, A.S. Neill, 60s educational philosophy. I don't know how much of it has survived, in which, actually some of it has survived. Exactly, the Sudbury Valley School that has been studied by Peter Gray, the author of the textbook that I've used in my course. The idea is if you throw children together, they are so intrinsically motivated to learn that structured curricula, homework, assignments, grading, segregation of children by ability are not necessary. The children have a natural tendency. Children want to learn. They take intrinsic pleasure in learning. Now, I think that's clearly not completely wrong, but I think it's also not completely right. That taking, say, ourselves in this room, probably in all of humanity, the kind of people that would be graduate students or faculty at a university like Harvard would be the ones with the strongest possible intrinsic motivation for learning. On the other hand, in each one of our biographies, we can think of cases where it wasn't a whole lot of fun to do the statistics homework or to look up every last reference or to, you know, triple and quadruple check your own assumptions to see if perhaps they were falsified by some inconvenient study. So a lot of learning is not immediately pleasant. It's got a kind of long-term reward. And so it isn't saying just that kids or anyone just likes to learn and will do so without any kind of external incentive structure would be a kind of romantic idea that I think is associated with the noble savage and that I think is unrealistic. Yes, Angie.
Just thinking of in terms of yourself in times that you feel particularly funny or loving or brilliant or something, do you have any difficulty reconciling the idea of the ghost, the machine, that it doesn't exist, and what are your ideas on subjective feelings and why we have them?
Well, the I think intuitively we all believe in the ghost and the machine. We're all dualists. That is, we believe that there is a mind or a soul that is somehow separate from the body. In a sense, that's what psychologists have in mind when they talk about the so-called theory of mind or intuitive psychology. If you're consistent mechanist, there's no such thing as a mind that's somehow different stuff than the body, but none of us can help feeling that way, myself included. In terms of the question of subjective experience, I find it useful to distinguish what the philosopher David Chalmers calls the easy problem of consciousness from the hard problem of consciousness. The easy problem of consciousness, that's kind of a joke because there's nothing easy about it. It's probably the hardest problem in science today, but it is a tractable problem, which is why it's called the easy problem, as a kind of a joke. That is, why does information processing in the brain seem to segregate into two pools, one of which we can't reflect on, we can't answer questions about, we can't control in terms of the immediate stimulation. Things like coughing, blinking, the motions that you use when you use a stick shift in your car if you've driven all your life, the computations that allow you to see in color or recognize objects as the same shape even if they move in depth. That would be one kind of information processing. Another kind would be me answering your question, looking around the room and noticing what people are wearing, deciding what you're going to have for lunch, and so on. So how are those different in terms of information processing? What's the difference in terms of the physiology of the brain? Why in evolution did these two kinds of information processing arise? All of those are the easy problem of consciousness, meaning that in 100 years maybe we'll kind of have some good ideas about them. The hard problem is the ones that a hard problem embraces the set of problems that philosophers often worry about, such as how do I know that my red is the same as your red? Maybe we have see the red in different ways but just give them the same label. Or how do we know whether a paramecium feels pain? How do we know whether Lieutenant Commander Data on Star Trek is conscious or whether he's just going through the motions very convincingly? There are many philosophers who believe that these are not meaningful questions at all, and that by posing them you're just revealing how confused you are conceptually. Dan Dennett would be an example. I think that goes too far, although I would agree that these are not scientific problems and that we probably won't get much traction on them. I'm partial to a solution, an observation by Colin McGinn, philosopher at Rutgers, that there may be some aspects of the reality that our minds just are not capable of thinking about without getting confused, because of the way our minds are put together. And the fact that particular kind of information processing in neural tissue feels like something on the inside might be something that we recognize to be true, but that we will not be able to satisfy ourselves with in terms of a causal explanation. It may be a case we have to say it just is. Yes.
Hi. I have a question regarding the what I read from your book is the randomness of this parenting effect, and with the 90% of your equation is beyond our control, which means 50% genetic, another 45-50 is chance factor. Does that mean all the educational enterprises like Reggio, Montessori, and other kinds of schools, which is there some part of their function is to improve human general intelligence and characters is moot?
No. And again, I guess this came up in the first question as well. Just to be clear, this is the conclusion about the effects of genetics on and chance on individual variation is for personality traits, for intelligence in terms of a lifelong ability to solve problems and learn. It doesn't refer, of course, to stuff you know. There's no way, whether someone knows how to read or not is going to be affected almost entirely by whether they've been taught to read. Whether they know who was the first president is going to be determined 100% by environmental experiences, and genetics is not going to have anything to do with it.
Yeah, I understand. I'm also referring to the general intelligence and characters. Those schools want to teach you to be a better person,
well,
a creative person.
Again, to take a step back, in terms of when these studies allude to intelligence, what they generally allude to is measures on intelligence tests, which some of the variants probably can be affected by schooling. There's a reason to believe that it is. It tends not to be measured in these tests, often because they look at these large samples in which there aren't radical differences in schooling. But the point of schools is not entirely, or I don't even know in part, is to raise IQ, but rather to get kids to know more. to know how to read, to know subject matter, to know about their culture. And the question of whether it's going to raise intelligence in the sense of IQ scores, I think, is a separate one. It's not clear what the answer to that is. But regardless of what the answer is, we still want to teach kids to read and to write and history and you know, where their culture came from and how the world works and so on.
Can I intervene a bit? When you're talking about personality, there's a question about where the searchlight is being shined, or more broadly, what do you mean by personality? And mostly you're talking about research that focuses on 2 to 5 dimensions of personality, I believe, that are most commonly studied, like introversion, extroversion, and anxiety proneness. There are a few studies that have looked at some other aspects of personality and suggest a very different pattern of findings. I don't think you addressed them in the book, so I wanted to see what you think about them. The ones I know the best look at relationships, the sorts of things that attachment theorists talk about. Studies by Niels Waller, Phil Shaver come to mind. And they find, with behavior genetic methodologies, that most of the variance in measures of relationship quality are determined by family environment and very little by genetics. That would seem to be an important aspect of personality. And I wonder, if you might speak to that hypothesis and more broadly the question of where is the searchlight shining in these studies, and should it be shining more broadly or looking at a wider range of personality measures.
Yeah. It's true that the majority of the studies look at things that are easiest to measure, which are the things that you can give personality tests on.
Right.
Partly because to do a behavioral genetic analysis properly, you need enormous sample sizes. And so anything that requires a lot of micro measurement is less likely to be done. I wasn't aware of the Shaver study.
Those are easy to measure, too. It's just questionnaires about what your relationships are like.
Yeah. There are some studies that I'm aware of that have attempted to find or made claims about effects of shared environment, although the thing to keep in mind is that when I present the overall picture of the results, as summarized by people like Eric Turkheimer, who pretty much says that these three generalizations apply to everything. Now, of course, everything is a lot of stuff, and there may be some local exceptions. It tends to be true that the claims in the literature, and this is sort of a meta comment, that claims of a shared environment often are the ones that are least likely to replicate. Now, I don't know about the Shaver study, but just as an example, there's a study in Psychological Science a couple of years ago that found that altruism had a significant shared environment component. But then there was another study that showed that it had zero shared environment component. So there is a question of kind of robustness. But still, ultimately, it is an empirical question, and it's certainly possible that some of the things that are not measured by these tests or by other kind of overt measures of behavior where you have, you know, a graduate student with a clipboard and a little clicker counting, you know, aggressive acts in a schoolyard or things like that, there may be deeper things that could show more of an effect. The other comment is that in shared environment lumps together the effect of home, parents, sibling, typically peer groups, and neighborhood. And so shared environment, even if it accounts for 10% of the variance, that 10% is going to have to be divided up among those, you know, five components. And that's another reason why I think it's wise to be skeptical about effects of parents, even if there, in cases where there is an effective shared environment. But anyway, it is an empirical question, ultimately. Yeah. Yes.
Hi, I was really refreshed after reading your book about some of the things that I was prior cynical about, like about environmentalism and food production and stuff like that, probably because of the current state of the union and stuff, that maybe we wouldn't be getting somewhere. But you seem to have enlightened the fact that through, like, cultural, like, trading of ideas and stuff, like, often called, like, memes and stuff, we're going to evolve. And maybe to borrow the words of Chomsky and stuff, like, we're going to narrow that explanatory gap or that those dark mysteries and stuff that we seem to think that we wouldn't be able to satisfy. Do you think now that we'd be able to catapult into the future with narrowing these things and maybe actually with the thing that has made us survive so far in our survival as a species, it's not necessarily our biology, but our mind and our ideas, that maybe we'll save ourselves and save our biology through this gift we have called the mind.
Yeah, if I understood the question correctly, that kind of leaving people to their own devices in terms of what the natural emotions and patterns of thinking that are common to the species and that are can be explained in part by evolution, I think is not going to get us where we want to go. Very artificial cultural mechanisms such as education, such as literacy, such as exchange of ideas is what's democratic argumentation. Things that are actually quite unnatural in the history of our species are going to lead to more of what we value the most. An example just being, an obvious example is democracy itself, which is, I think, by just about every measure, the best form of social organization that we've managed to come up with so far, but which is rather rare in human history and which required a lot of argumentation and deliberation and experimentation, and which, of course, is an ongoing experiment. It's nowhere near as good as we have reason to believe it could be. Science, formal science, is another. International treaties, all of these things are very, I think, unnatural biologically, but we've managed to put together a contraption where we understand how they work. We've got to keep at it so that it doesn't deteriorate, not hope that human nature by itself will get us out of our current predicaments. Yes?
Yeah. I was wondering what you thought this research, what the implications were for parenting, and if you say that a lot of these, parenting theories that have been going around really do have little effect, what are the implications for families, decision-making, should the mother stay at home, should the mother work, does it really, there isn't really an effect if the mother, puts her kid in daycare or spends a lot of time with the child. Also, I was wondering how this is related to issues, for example, like abuse, physical or sexual abuse, what the effects of children are on that. And I guess my question was partially answered by what you were explaining about what can be taught, because I'm assuming then parents can teach their children how to read, and this can have a huge effect. But basically, it's just a general question about implications for parenting.
Yeah. Well, there's several cases in which where it's clear that parents can make a difference. One of them is choosing the child's peer environment, their school, their neighborhood. Another is in teaching particular skills, reading, math, musical instrument. Another is, I think in terms of the question of abuse both sexual and physical, there are an awful lot of reasons not to abuse a child physically or sexually, regardless of what the long-term effects are on personality. And that is that they're horrible things for one person to do to another, in particular a big strong person to do to a small helpless one. And that, for one thing, the effects are certainly outside the range of most of these studies, since they do look at, they tend to be within the law-abiding range as opposed to the criminal range. And so if there's a large study of adoptive families, most of them will not physically or sexually abuse their children. And so any such effects will not be measurable by those studies. That having been said, there's, I think, the issue of whether child, if parental advice is, should I sexually abuse my child, then the answer is no, for moral reasons. That parents have an enormous effect on the happiness of their children. Again, Harris is very good with nice lapidary statements. The way she puts it is, we may not hold our children's tomorrows in our hands, but we surely hold their todays. And we have Right. They have the power to make them very miserable.
Right. When I read that sentence in your chapter on children, I was wondering, I mean, don't our today's affect our tomorrow's? I was a little unclear what the point of that sentence
was. Well, maybe they do.
I just didn't understand. I'm not.
Yeah, maybe they do, but maybe they don't. But in either case, the effect of parents on a child's happiness and well-being is enormous. Whether spanking a child or beating a child will turn them into a different person 20 years from now is I think, not the main issue in terms of whether a parent should beat up a child. So it is for many other differences in parenting that should be in a parent's mind. Even if it doesn't affect what the child 20 years from now, other than, of course, memories of how they were treated, which is part of our own personal autobiography and therefore an integral component of the kind of the story we tell ourselves about who we are, and therefore there could be painful effects of having a cruel parent above and beyond whether it actually makes you into a different kind of person or not. So at that human level, there are many reasons for parents to be kind to their children as opposed to cruel. Whether it's because if you have a cruel child that will make them phobic or shy or neurotic over the long term, I think is another question. It's an empirical question. I think it's accepted on rather flimsy grounds, largely because people confuse it with the moral issue of whether parents should be nice or cruel to their children. And if you separate them, those questions, namely that parenting is above all an ethical responsibility, then we'd probably know the answer to the question of whether it has a long-term effect more accurately, and regardless of what the facts turn out to be, then we can have a policy about how parents ought to treat their children that will be as humane as possible. Let's give you be concrete. There was a furor about 5 years ago, some of you may be familiar with it, where someone published a study in the American Psychologist said that the effects of sexual abuse are in adulthood are rather small. That is, contrary to widespread belief, adults aren't messed up because they were abused as children or vice versa. That most cases of sexual abuse don't lead to a personality change. Now, this was denounced by Dr. Laura. It was denounced in Congress. The APA tried to... Sorry, it wasn't American Psychology. It was a Psychological Bulletin. The APA tried to distance itself from the study after... a number of congressmen kind of called the APA on the carpet for publishing it. This because people confused the question of should sexual abuse be tolerated, and the answer is no, with the question of can you measure some effect of sexual abuse later in life. There are lots of reasons why sexual abuse shouldn't be tolerated. Whether or not this study, this meta-analysis, was sound or not is something that we should get to the bottom of without it serving as a referendum for whether sexual abuse is okay or not. At least so I would argue. Yes?
If such a huge part of the variance of personality is so predetermined, then what are your thoughts on clinical psychology, whether it be with children or with adults in schools, because it seems like a lot of clinical psychology is focused on basically changing personality and helping those with mental illness or helping those with different types of personality issues to overcome those issues.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, again, as with education, it's dangerous to make generalizations about psychotherapy in general because there's so many differences among therapists. And I think a good number of therapists, at least ones who've written me, have not expressed surprise at these findings, simply because if they had thought that they could change the personality of their clients, they were soon disabused. The statement that I like the best comes from Martin Seligman in his book Authentic Happiness, which acknowledges the substantial but not determining role of genetics in measures like susceptibility to depression and to levels of happiness in general. To a substantial extent, happiness is genetically affected. That is, good things happen to you, bad things happen to you. When good things happen to you, you get happier, and then you kind of go back to your baseline. When bad things happen to you, you get miserable, and then you return to your baseline. And the baseline is partly heritable, and surprisingly stable. So does that mean therapists shouldn't try to make people happier? No, for a couple, two reasons. Again, I'm citing Seligman. One is that there's always a range of levels of happiness within which that the genes leave open. It can be a considerable range. There's no reason not to try to be as high as possible within that range. Second is that there's more to life than happiness, and it may be futile to try to get a sad sack to turn into a barrel of monkeys. I mean, we know people who are just jolly and some people who are kind of morose, and it might be a waste of time to try to turn one into the other. But in terms of why, what's the meaning of life? Why are we here? What do we want to strive for? Being cheerful a large percentage of the day is not the only one. There are things like connection to family and friends and community, artistic accomplishment, scientific accomplishment, professional accomplishment, making the world a better place, all kinds of things that if you accomplish them may not actually make you kind of more bouncy and bubbly, may not even make you happy in the terms of the question you ask someone, are you happy? They may not say 7 on a 7-point scale, but people do cite as things that they're proud of, satisfied about on a deep level, and that dimension of achievement perhaps can be affected in a way that happiness per se may not be, or at least not as much as people tend to think. Yes.
Hi. I'm particularly interested in how you view the use of or the rise of cognitive science and evolutionary psychology to the arts. In your statement, you said that you think it will become a growth area in criticism and scholarship. And it's a two-part question. The first part is that if you believe that there will be a rise in criticism and scholarship, in what form do you think those studies will take? And the second part is that if we can find answers to that, would it, in your own opinion again, would it be a Rosetta Stone kind of theorem whereby that would explain the phenomenon of art itself, or is it more to your analogy of adding empirical evidence to how the world works, you know, that two-tier relationship you mentioned earlier about assumption of the world and how explaining how the mind works would help it? Thank you.
Yeah, I think there are several parts to that question. In terms of what I think would be a growth area of scholarship, I think asking the question of both why do particular kinds of art seem satisfying, why are they universal, is one kind of question. Why an completely unsolved problem in psychology, biology, evolution is why people enjoy music in all cultures. That's, I think, a profound intellectual puzzle. And then, more specifically, why does a particular work of art resonate, last, satisfy, enlighten, and so on? Clearly, something like evolutionary psychology or cognitive psychology per se is more suited to ask the first question than the second one, because the second one is going to depend so much on the particulars of that work. On the other hand, I think that there will be principles from a number of areas of psychology that will be relevant that haven't been fully explored. In the case of literature, for example, how does a very nice example is the book by Elaine Scarry here in the English department, Dreaming by the Book, on how authors use the faculty of mental imagery in their readers in order to convey a shift in viewpoints, a particular approach or understanding to a scene, all depending on the vantage point, the mental vantage point that the reader constructs as a result of the author's activities. How linguistic structure is used by poets, meter, rhyme, stress, accent, metaphor. Evolutionary psychology can, I think, contribute something in terms of the kinds and nature of human conflict that are played out as plots in drama and fiction. It's often said that there's a finite number of plots in the world's stories. I think connecting those plots to the kinds of human conflicts that are part of our biological condition can provide insight. In terms of cinema, how visual attention is manipulated by a good director. In terms of visual arts, both the kind of work that was explored to some extent in the teens and 20s on how perception of color and form and shape are exploited by visual artists. But something that I think could profitably be revisited now that we have a better understanding of visual perception. So these are all examples, I think, of how psychology and the arts could be profitably brought together. There was, I briefly mentioned in this book, something that I learned from my colleague at MIT, Marianne Teuber, that there actually was early in the century a much stronger connection between science and art than we enjoy today. In particular, psychological science, and Marianne Teuber has some documentary evidence that Gertrude Stein, who was a student of William James here at Harvard, did an interesting bachelor's thesis on attention, went over to Europe, brought with her William James's ideas and the ideas of the German psychologists about perception, illusions, attention, and so on into her salon, and many of these ideas got incorporated into the work of visual artists such as Picasso, Braque, and later Paul Klee, and that there also were connections between the school of Gestalt psychology and the Bauhaus, and the idea that there was world of the visual arts and then a world of the sciences that were in separate buildings that had nothing to do with each other is much more recent, and that we might profitably try to get back to some of the crosstalk that was enjoyed in the teens and 20s. Yeah.
I want to go back to the point. I think that Kurt made a very shining spotlight, and I don't want to repeat it.
I'm having a little trouble hearing. Is the mic on?
I think it's on. Oh, there we go. Yeah, I want to go back to one, Kurt's point about where to shine the spotlight. One of the things that struck me perhaps as most uninteresting about what your book had to say, I found what was interesting, I think that debunking the myths and going by hard empirical science to disprove common assumptions we have is very important, but it seems that a lot of the measurements that we have and those that we can use are actually forms of measurement such as IQ or personality that have been perfected and refined to measure stable aspects of ourselves that by definition are therefore most likely to be genetic. So the result of a lot of these studies is therefore to say we have a test like an IQ test or personality test which has shown to be stable no matter what someone experiences, and therefore we're going to go back and look at what they experience and come to the conclusion that their environment didn't change this. Well, that to me doesn't seem very useful, because I think so much of what we're trying to do is to devise mechanisms for measuring those things that have not been traditionally so easy to capture. So I'm just curious as to, I know that we can't just, you're an empiricist, not a theorist, you can't just assume that something's not chance, but like as an example, the sexual abuse studies, it's very interesting that you know, someone that's been sexually abused, their personality may not have changed dramatically. However, that common use of the form personality that most of your readers have is very different than the very constrained, you know, tests of personality, which I think would most likely conform to a genetic factors, because basically what they're trying to do is be successful, being stable, and being stable is the part of the stable part of personalities of things that we would expect genetics to attribute to, and the environment would obviously not contribute to the stable parts, but to the more changing and complex and instable. So, I mean, I'm not sitting here to, you know, criticize some of these conclusions, but just to say, doesn't it seem as though there will be a time, maybe if it's not now, where empirical science can speak to some of these more complex forms and maybe change your idea that it's pure chance?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true that there are there's some things that are more readily measured and more likely, therefore, to submit to this kind of analysis. And traits like whether you're neurotic or self-satisfied, how you rate your happiness level, and also behavioral measures. It's not just self-reports, but behavioral measures such as susceptibility to alcoholism, drug addiction, divorce, criminality, number of hours of television watched. All of these fall under generalization as well. And they're certainly consequential in our lives, whether someone gets divorced or not, whether you think of someone as basically a kind person or an aggressive person, neurotic or self-satisfied. These are not trivial dimensions of our personality or of human experience. But granted, there are also other aspects of being a human being that are not measured at all by personality in these senses. I mean, these senses are, I think, validated in terms of things like the adjectives that we use to describe people tend to correlate fairly well with what these tests tend to measure. On the other hand, there are other aspects of our experience that clearly don't. I mean, let's say you were betrayed by a good friend 10 years before. Just wounded to the core by some act of treachery. Now, does that affect you? Well, clearly it affects you. Does it change your personality? Well, probably not. Perhaps cumulatively a number of episodes like that may have. Perhaps it's a matter of chance whether it did or not. Nonetheless, it's whether or not it exerts those changes, it's obviously a significant component of our own inner lives and our own the stories we tell to ourselves about what has happened to us, who we are, how we got to where we are, what matters to us. So, and it's true that those measures and being abused as a child might be one of them. Having been divorced, having been through a national crisis like a national disaster or wartime, it would be ridiculous to say that these don't have an effect. Whether they change your personality, though, is not a more important or a less important question, but it is a different question. Even with those, by the way, it's not clear that those will be predicted by objectively measured external events any more than the personality measures would. Even something like getting divorced can have a huge effect on one person and not such a big effect on another person. We don't really know why. But nonetheless, it's a whole realm of effects that are distinct from personality and are important in a different way.
Do you mind if I don't use the mic? Because I've been coughing a lot. And I guess everybody can hear me. I don't want to. But I guess that I had two questions, and maybe I misunderstood what I read in your book, but I thought I understood that you see the family as not being that important. In comparison with, for example, the social group. Did I understand
it? Well, again, it depends on. I never say not important because the question is important to what. I think it's obviously important to the child's happiness while the child is in the home. It's important to this personal autobiography that I just alluded to. It's important as part being embedded in a context of a neighborhood and a culture. What it's probably not important to is socialization within the culture and the shaping of personality.
Then I guess that my two questions are, one is, if you look at kind of evolutionary psychology, and we can consider what was happening thousands of years ago to be crucial to who we are today, then why wouldn't what happened 10 years ago also be powerful in helping to form who we become? That's the first part. And then the second part is actually unrelated, but I just wanted to kind of throw it in. If I understood that you have this, I believe that you were saying that being able to distinguish between living and non-living things is something that's kind of intuitive or inborn. But I'm a little skeptical about that because I know that when I was a child, I was pretty sure that when I walked out of the room, my stuffed animals were all going to come to life and kind of show who they really were. And I think that a lot of kids have that sort of idea about like their dolls and their animals. So I'm not sure that the difference between what's living and what's not is really is that clear. I kind of do think we need to learn that. Maybe that's part of what superstition or magic is about, or maybe that's related to that idea.
Yeah. I'll deal with those the two questions separately. As for the first one, I've discovered in speaking about the ideas in the blank slate to an enormous number of audiences, both live, university, bookstore, radio, etc., that people have are very puzzled by the idea that children could learn and be affected by one aspect of the environment, but not learn, or at least learn different things and being affected by the other aspect of the environment. And I attribute this to the blank slate model of socialization and learning, in which the child would be passively written on or molded by environmental influences. That, I find, is the mental model that many people come from, and then upon hearing that that's not the most fruitful way of thinking about it, many people don't entertain other possibilities for how information from the environment could be used by the child. So if you do a gestalt shift, okay, forget the blank slate, forget the lump of putty, the child is an organism that actively, energetically, exuberantly takes in information from the environment for certain purposes in order to prosper in certain ways. So you're a child, you want to have friends, you want to be respected within your peer group, just like we adults want to be respected within our peer group. Because we're adults, we get not to call it a peer group, because that's kind of condescending. We call it our colleagues, our professional environment, and so on. We're sensitive to what it takes to get ahead, what earns us respect, what earns us opprobrium. So are kids. Now, this doesn't mean being insensitive to the environment. It just means being attuned to some aspects of the environment for some purposes. Getting back to evolution, if you think, what's the point of being a child? Okay, I mean, that sounds like an odd question. A child, every stage in the lifespan is a target of natural selection. It's not as if natural selection kind of, the product of evolution is something that gets popped into the world and then is subject to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. But at every life stage, there are certain biological problems that have to be solved, and there's reason to believe that the child or adult is adapted to solve them. The main problem in childhood is getting out of it alive, because children are small and vulnerable and helpless, and that means that one of the first things children have to do early on in life is get a parent to be willing to invest in them, to feed them, protect them, and so on. And that's why you have things like crying and brattiness and having big, fat, cute cheeks and big eyes and all the other adaptations of children that manipulate parents. But when children are ambulatory, one of the main challenges of life is to become part of society, which for the child means becoming part of the society of children, i.e. their peer group, and in particular finding a mate once they become adolescents. And there's a lot of work that shows that kids who have higher status within their same-sex peer group are the earliest to date and are the most popular with the opposite sex, because you want to date the person who is considered, who's respected by, you know, the other boys or the other girls. And so there's every reason to have a set of antennae for what counts as worthy of status and respect in your peer group. Kids are, in that regard, are not much different from adults. And because of that adaptive problem of becoming popular, earning respect, gaining esteem, being popular to members of the opposite sex, it's something you'd an aspect of the environment that you'd expect children to be especially receptive to. And accent, again, is just a very, very clear case. The fact that children don't learn their parents' accent doesn't mean that they're insensitive to the environment. It just means that they choose which aspect of the environment is most worthy of attention and most informative in terms of how they should shape their own behavior. Okay, the second question, in terms of whether children have some innate intuition of living versus non-living, the case of stuffed animals is not, if anything, I think it would make the opposite point, that what is a stuffed animal? It's something that has been manufactured with the intent of being as lifelike as possible and of tricking whatever animacy detectors we have into making us think that a hunk of matter is actually a living thing. That's why we have stuffed toys. Where the manufacturers of stuffed toys are deliberately trying to fool the child into thinking that something is like a cuddly animal, which in fact is just a bunch of terry cloth. But the more general point that you make, I think, is valid, in that a lot of superstition and indeed religion can be understood in terms of taking our perception of living and extending it to things that we as sophisticated biologists would not call living, such as the attributing spirits to trees and rocks and rivers, attributing spirits that aren't connected to any matter whatsoever, namely souls, spirits, ghosts, demons, and so on. And it's precisely because we have this major conceptual divide between the living and the non-living, the animate and the inanimate, that you have the scope for all of these misconceptions. So I think any viable theory of sort of innate animism wouldn't say that we have an accurate perception of what's animate and what isn't, just that we divide the universe into that. We have pretty strong intuitions about some very clear prototypical examples of each, but the boundaries are very much in flux, and in fact there seems to be a very strong bias to overextend the mindful or animate side to things that we now recognize are not animate.
Steve, let me interrupt for a second.
Yeah.
There's time for a few more questions, but you've addressed, as of when I talked with you, 80 different audiences about this book. It's probably double that by now. What is a question that's been raised that's given you the most pause? And I'll project here, but it typically would be something that nobody had raised when you were writing the book, and so you didn't really deal with it. And after the book came out, and the book got a huge number of reviews with a huge range of reactions, so I'm interested in kind of what would you like to have either rethought or you want to rethink now?
Let's see. It's not that they're my puzzlement right now is not that there aren't ones, but let me see if I can time travel back to when I wrote the book and what do I know now that I didn't know then, simply because my own story is adapted to the kinds of questions that I get. Certainly I think the aspect of the common understanding that the book tried to deconstruct that I didn't appreciate enough was, I think, the issue of environmental influence versus blank slate. The idea that if we're affected by the environment, it's by being passively shaped by it, as opposed to actively seeking out some aspects, that I think I didn't appreciate that's a distinction that should have been made up front. So just even to make it more concrete, and I've heard it in a number of the questions here, but someone actually stated in a particularly bald fashion. They said, isn't it a logical contradiction to say that children are shaped by their peers and not by their parents? Now, obviously, it's not a logical contradiction, but why would an intelligent person frame the question that way? And I think it's because the environment is seen as a single causal force, and so if the environment, then the issue is, does the environment affect you or not? Therefore, the environment that you encounter for a larger number of hours has to have that much more of an effect than an environment which you spend a minority of your hours. So that's one thing. Another is, this is something I was aware of that I probably should have addressed more, and that is the whole idea of interactionism. A lot of people say that the nature-nurture debate is obsolete because everyone recognizes that everything is an interaction at every level, that genes interact with the intracellular environment, which interacts with the extracellular environment, that it's naive to even talk about nature because it's so intermingled with nurture at every level of development. That's a kind of reaction that I get, in particular in reviews that try to say, well, the whole approach is naive because we've gone beyond it. And I'm going to write something that deals with that.
In the Boston Globe with
that. Yes, that's right. That was indeed. The what I wrote in the Boston Globe was a reaction to that kind of response. The reaction is, my response to that is that there's a danger in that becoming a kind of obscurantism, that everything affects everything else in such a manner that it's simplistic to even try to disentangle them. And first of all, just methodologically, it's not, no matter how complicated something is, it's never simplistic to try to disentangle it. That's what science is for, is to disentangle complex things in terms of simpler interacting parts, one of which is the genetically influenced characteristics of the brain. Another is that if you posit that everything that affects everything else, that is actually an empirical claim, and it's dogmatic to say that it must be so without actually testing to see if it's so. And in some of the diagrams that one sees in terms of how complicated everything is, people will write things like parents, peers, school, genes, chance, nutrition, etc., and have everything connected to everything else and say, no picture that's less complex than that will do. Well, it's not only that that's not very helpful, but also it could be false. I mean, some of those arrows may not actually be there. And just as, say, again, I'll be very concrete, in the case of accent, the arrow from parents to child in the terms of determining the accent shouldn't be there. It's just not an arrow there. It's peers to child, and it's not even a mixture of parents to child and parents to child. It's 100% peers, 0% parents. That's not simplistic. That's an empirical fact. Dealing with this seeming alternative view of inexplicably intertwined, interconnected interaction, I think is the main thing that I didn't properly defend myself against in the book, in which I hope to do now.
Why don't you take a couple more questions and then we'll express our appreciation.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is about your treatment of environment. Maybe it's a larger question about the treatment of environment as I've kind of been reading it. Environment with a big E, like a broadsword, that all these variables that are just completely variable are affecting us in some way, and up to 50% of them might be affecting us. But in fact, my question is, as different generations use these variables differently. An example would be New York City over industrial, social, organizational revolutions from, I guess, pre-20th century to the present has gone through a ton of changes. And that urban culture has completely changed. We could argue the people and the way they've developed has completely changed as well. Are these actual variables calculated, and are they becoming more calculatable as we kind of make our lives more insular? I guess as a Western urban culture, because I guess we can argue that much of the United States is becoming urban, if not suburban.
Yeah. Again, this is this kind of change would go into the category of cultural influences on many things, perhaps on personality, but certainly on knowledge, values, behavior, and so on. So again, it's the kind of environmental effect that is not addressed in studies of personality variation within a culture. There certainly are. I mean, in fact, something that I find very extremely interesting is what the statisticians and demographers call secular trends, things that consistent changes that occur over decades or centuries that sometimes we can understand, sometimes we don't. An example that I do talk about in the book is violence. How, if you look at the trend over the last 1,000 years, then we're becoming much less violent in the West. Homicide rates of deadly ethnic riots and pogroms, willingness to go to war. All of these things have gone way down insofar as we can measure them. And I suspect that part of the answer is a institutional change in the culture that leads to a change in attitudes, namely having a democratically controlled police force and less and less of the country and of the Western world lives in a state of anarchy, such as in, you know, West Virginia hills 100 years ago, or the Wild West, or we still see it in places like the Balkans, which have been outside the control of a stable democratic law enforcement system. But in that regard, I'm with Hobbes, who said that people who are not living under the control of a Leviathan, an armed government, are likely to be at each other's throats, and that with a stable rule of law and order, we're much more likely to live in peace. Other secular trends, of course, I should add a coda to that, is that's assuming that we can police the police, since the police are no nicer than anyone else. Another one is the Flynn effect, that for 60 or 70 years we've been getting smarter, at least insofar as intelligence, whatever component of intelligence is measured by the G factor in IQ tests. No one knows why. None of the explanations are any good. We've been getting more anxious, at least over the last 50 years. I think that the reason is probably that we know more, the world really is out to get you, and the more you know about it, the more nervous you are. A trivial example. My parents, when they were in their 20s, you know, didn't worry about wearing sunscreen because no one knew that the sun can kill you. They didn't worry about, you know, butter and steaks. No one thought that your pat of butter could kill you. There's just an enormous range of things that we're now aware of that are part of our everyday psychological load. We're getting fatter. Another one that does not have a genetic explanation, and again, none of the explanations that are out there is particularly good. I don't think it's McDonald's fault, because if you go to a, you know, mom and pop Italian restaurant in a neighborhood, you'll get many more calories than you will from a Big Mac, but people eat more of them and restaurants offer more of them. So there are a lot of changes like that, which kind of collectively are social change viewed over the centuries, but if you put a microscope to them, are psychological changes as well, in terms of the interaction between the choices an individual makes and the larger incentive structure. I think that it's kind of a fascinating topic, and one that for which in large part we don't have good explanations.
One final sharp question.
Yes.
Hopefully this will be a good one, because it does tie back to education too, which is important. Going back to, you're talking about the innate concepts, and you listed, you know, physics, biology, psychology, and I really liked your examples of how you can use that in education, like using graphs, building on children's understanding of spatial relationships. And I'm wondering if you had any suggestions for people in this room, maybe who want to try to make those connections from how children develop concepts, understanding of concepts, and translating that into education practices.
Yeah. Well, this is one that I think that is a profound question, one of the most interesting questions in education. It's one that I think is probably better answered by my colleagues, so Howard in particular, Susan Carey and Elizabeth Spelke. Just to give one example, an interplay between the concept of number and the concept of matter, where Susan Carey has shown that the children will give what we now think of as funny answers to certain questions about matter, such as, how much does this piece of styrofoam weigh? And children will say, nothing. Or if you take a piece of wood and you keep cutting it into half and then half and then half and smaller bits, will you eventually get to a piece so small that it has no wood inside it? And kids will say yes. Now, why do we know that these are wrong answers? I mean, they're not, we can't, clearly you can't feel the pressure that styrofoam applies, because your hand, like any measuring device, has a threshold. Likewise, since your perceptual system has a threshold, there will be a a point at which the piece of wood is so small that you can't see it. So it is nothing with respect to our apparatus. Why do we know that it's not nothing? It's so Susan Carey argues. It's because we have the mathematical concept of division, that if you keep dividing a number, you never, over and over again, you never get to zero, and that there can be a number that's as small as you want, but still distinct from zero. And so it's a case in which our mathematical understanding informs our physical understanding. This probably goes in both directions. In fact, probably more often in one direction than the other. We probably learn mathematics by reference to physical intuitions such as aggregation, division, sharing, reapportionment, and so on. But there's probably a two-way traffic. And if we understood that two-way traffic, we might be more effective both at getting kids to learn physics by applying what they know about number, and perhaps vice versa.
Folks, you may not be aware that almost 2 hours have elapsed, and except for judicial proceedings, individuals are rarely subjected to a barrage of questions for that last period of time. Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for all of you.